have now asked Liz S. to come up and introduce our speaker.
Hey everybody, I'm Liz. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to see everybody out tonight. Sin Law Sober Mania 2021. It's so exciting to be a part of this. So 2 years ago, I guess the same weekend, I was fresh out of my very last stay ever at the psych ward. And here I am back in my hometown thinking like, great, I'm back in AA here. And some people in my home group were talking about going to Sin Law Sober Mania, and I was like, well, why not? You know, and so I showed up, and my life has never been the same. It struck me, the vibrancy of recovery in my hometown. I couldn't believe it. The speakers were amazing. The Big Book trivia was just super fun, even though I may not have won. I just loved it. And so I knew that this was something I wanted to be a part of. And so as we were getting ready to put on the conference this year, Wendy and I were listening to, I don't know how many speaker tapes. We listened to so many. And there was one in particular from Atlanta in 2014 that was just like hilarious. And Wendy was like, I got to find this guy. And I'm like, yeah, good luck, because nobody can use their last name. You can't just look somebody up in the white pages. So some guy named John from Atlanta. So Wendy calls the local Atlanta group of Alcoholics Anonymous. She Googles the number, and lo and behold, John answers. So it kind of seemed like it was meant to be. So I'm very privileged and honored to introduce from the Fifth Traditions group of Atlanta, John S.
Hey, everybody, I'm John Shires. I'm an alcoholic. That's a really funny story, actually, how Wendy got a hold of me. We were actually on our 25th wedding, our anniversary, on our honeymoon, or anniversary, back in Hawaii. We went there on our honeymoon 25 years before. We went back there, and COVID had just opened up, and we had to take like 16 tests to get into Hawaii and all this mess, and we all kind of travel problems. We finally get there, and we're driving down the road, and I get a text. Because I was the web chair for my home group. We have a website. We put our speakers from our Saturday night speaker meeting up there. And there's a little form. Like, if you want to be contacted by an alcoholic, you know, put your info in here. So I get a text. Bing! And it's just, hey, do you know John S., the speaker? And I called her. And it was me. And I was in Hawaii. And so God's will gets done in this deal, you know. And it just happens in weird ways. And really, that whole thing about any of our stories who've been here for a little while is this... really weird journey that we're all on, you know, trying to get connected to a power greater than ourselves that I choose to call God. And I still don't understand the meaning of that word. For me, it's just a placeholder word for everything miraculous that happens that without my understanding or knowledge. And there's been a lot of that. So, but I'm really honored and pleased to be here tonight. And hello, Zoomers. You know, I want to say hi to the Zoom folks. It's really nice to be in person, but it's also really nice to have this technology and be able to carry the message. You know, my home group, we were not able to meet in person for 16 months during the pandemic. And Atlanta was shut down hard, and it was hit hard with COVID, and people were dying and all this. And we started on Zoom, and we thought, oh, it'll be a month. Turned into 16 months. And we have a big group. My home group is about 200 members. And we have a big Saturday night speaker meeting in a hall about this size. And, you know, and we were able to keep the group together. And there's a whole bunch of people. This is really amazing to me, because I would not have thought this was possible. A whole bunch of people got sober on Zoom. Got sober on Zoom. Never went to coffee. Never went to dinner after the meeting. You know, never got to hang out and play spades and try to sleep with somebody till 3 a.m. You know, which is the way I got sober. But I use the word sober very loosely in that particular version of that story. But I'll get to that. Anyway, my home group's the Fifth Tradition group. That's in Atlanta, Georgia. We meet Thursday nights for a big book study. It's a closed meeting. We meet Saturday nights for a speaker meeting. That's an open meeting. And we have a Zoom meeting Zoom step study meeting on Tuesday nights. And we have a newcomers meeting on Thursday nights before our big book study. And if you're ever in Atlanta, I want you to come see us. And I promise, we have greeters at the door, and they will shake your hand and welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. We got coffee. We got cookies. We got a whole huge energetic group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a three legacies group, man. We exist for one reason, to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to people that have not heard it yet. You know, and the funny thing about that is I was in Alcoholics Anonymous for 2.5 years before I heard it. I don't know if there's anybody else in this room can relate to that. I was around AA for a long time before I heard the message. You know, like I said, the message that I heard when I got here is go to a crap load of meetings, drink a crap load of coffee, smoke a crap load of cigarettes, and have as much sex as you can, and you'll stay sober. Now, no one was pushing that message, but that's the message that I heard. Now, spoiler alert, that version of an AA recovery program did not work. I just want to put that out there, you know. I know some people probably work in that program right now. No judgment. I love you. I love you. Anyway, that's my home group, and so come see us if you're in Atlanta. My sobriety date is March 7th, 1989, and that is 100% by the grace of God. And the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my prayer tonight is that some of my experience and my story will help somebody in here who needs to hear some of the mistakes that I made. You know, I'm a big believer in talking about the mistakes. You know, sometimes we'll hear a speaker get up here and say, now look, I'm not going to talk about drinking because we all know how to drink. You know, and I'm not going to talk about the problem because we all know what the problem is. I'm just going to talk about how spiritual I am. And that's fine, all well and good. But I think you lose the newcomer. If I just got up here and said, man, I'm rich and I got God in my life and I got a nice car and I got a nice job, the newcomer's just going to be like, you know, what can they relate to with that? You know, you're just a jerk. That's what the newcomer's going to think, you know. But when I sit up here and I talk about the humiliation and the pain and the suffering of active alcoholism and the humiliation and the pain and the suffering of sober, untreated alcoholism, which is probably worse, honestly, because, man, there's nothing worse than being a full-blown alcoholic and having no alcohol, no drugs, nothing to take the edge off my life and still have no spiritual program of action. And in that in-between place, and we lose a lot of people, man. And I almost got lost for that very reason, and I'll get to that. But anyway, I grew up in Tampa, Florida. I'm Southern, big crazy Southern family, mostly from Georgia, Virginia, some Alabama connections. And but, you know, we were way too white trash to live in those nice states, so we all moved to Florida. And but I grew up in a good family. I mean, I say that tongue in cheek. I realize today, and let me just say this, today, what I'm telling you is 32 years of sobriety, and looking back over my life, and I see things a lot clearer today than I saw them when I was new. Because when I was new, I would have told you my family was sorry as hell and rotten and mean and didn't understand me and didn't love me and didn't care about me. And I realize today they absolutely love me. I have a big, loving family. Now, they are alcoholic. I have 7 brothers and sisters, and about half of us are alcoholic. And I say about because this is a program that's self-diagnosed, okay? I can't tell someone else they're an alcoholic. I have one alcoholic brother. He's sober, but he still smokes weed. He's California sober. And he lives in California. I have a sister who probably ought to be in here, but she probably ain't ever going to make it in here. And then there's some borderline cases amongst the other ones that we're just not sure about yet. But I came from a big, loving, gregarious, wackadoodle, alcoholic family. And my parents got divorced when I was young, and I lived with my mother. And my mother was the absolute most ridiculously committed Al-Anon angel that you ever saw in your life. I don't know if we got any Al-Anons in the room tonight, but we do got some Al-Anons. Good. So I'm going to tell you right now, I got to AA because of Al-Anon. And so Al-Anon works for the Al-Anons, and sometimes it even works for the damn alcoholics. And it did in my case. But my mother, she was not in Al-Anon. She was just a practicing Al-Anon, an untreated Al-Anon. And but she loved her boys. You know, my brothers and I, and she did everything for us. And I mean everything. When I grew up in a house, when I was a kid, I started reading at a young age, kind of a precocious reader, you know, obsessive compulsive reader. And I would read The Lord of the Rings, and she saw that I liked The Lord of the Rings, so she got an artist to come to my house and paint a mural across my 2 walls of my bedroom of The Lord of the Rings. Okay? One day she decided, she was quirky, she decided, you know what would be cool for my boys? A fire pole in the middle of the house. So she just built one. She just called the carpenter and said, I want you to put a fire pole in this house. Right here at the top of the stairs, going right to the kitchen. And so my house was the house growing up where every kid in the neighborhood was there. And we all ran down the hall and up the stairs and jumped on the fire pole and slid down and ran down the hall and run up the stairs. And it was chaos. And we had a half pipe skateboard ramp in my backyard. We were a bunch of skate rats. And so what I'm saying is I got a lot of love. I got a lot of love from an untreated Al-Anon nurse. And and she loved the hell out of my brothers and I. And if love was a cure for alcoholism, I'd have gotten sober. You know, if love kept someone from being an alcoholic, I'd have never been one. You know, and I see, because, you know, I was new, like a lot of us. I thought, oh, man, my mom, she overloved me. My dad underloved me. I mean, you better love me just right or I'm going to be an alcoholic, you know. And what I've come to realize is that really has nothing to do whether I'm an alcoholic. Some of us come from the most profoundly, my wife Kathy's here, she's going to speak on Sunday morning. She came from a profoundly abusive background. I came from a profoundly supportive background. Yet we're both just love, alcohol, and dope, you know. And I have a very special relationship to alcohol. I really, a profoundly special thing. And in the doctor's opinion, in the big book, is where I really get my diagnosis on this deal. You know, is when I take a drink, I cross the line somewhere where when I take a drink, something happens to me that don't happen to non-alcoholics. I get thirstier. You know, a drink kicks off the desire for another drink in me right past when I get drunk. You can get me completely and totally drunk and I still want another drink. There's this abnormal reaction, this like allergy-like thing that happens to me, and this phenomenon of craving, as the big book describes it. Where I start drinking, I start craving, and that's all there is to it. And then I get sober, and I totally quit, and then my mind kicks in and starts manufacturing reasons why I can try it again a different way, or just manufactures a wall between all the reasons why I shouldn't pick up again, and then I just pick up again, and then I start the whole cycle over. And that began for me, and I got sober young, y'all. I got sober 3 months shy of my 20th birthday, okay? And but I started drinking when I was 13. And my first drunk, I started drinking to get drunk at the age of 13. I came from a big alcoholic family, a big drinking family. You know, everybody drank in my family. I never ever saw an adult without a cigarette in one hand and a cocktail in the other hand growing up. Never ever did. And they were having fun, y'all. I mean, it looked like fun. I mean, my parents had parties. And everyone, I mean, when there was a big football game, big Bucks game, you know, I grew up in Tampa, which, I mean, there weren't many big Bucks games in those years growing up in Tampa, but whatever, any good excuse to drink beer and smoke cigarettes and watch football. So everyone would drink, and I would have a sip off my dad's beer, one of my older brother's beers, you know, kind of thing. I'd have a sip of my mom's wine, a sip off somebody's cocktail. But at the age of 13, I went out deliberately with three friends in my neighborhood to get drunk. And I was 13 years old, 120, 130 pounds max, 2 quarts of malt liquor, Mickey's Mean Green malt liquor, 2 quarts. And 2 quarts of Mickey's Mean Green malt liquor transformed me into the person I wanted to be. That is the magic that alcohol has on me. I became someone I didn't know I could be. I didn't know I was that person. You know, the person that I am with 2 quarts of malt liquor in me is way better than the person that I am sober. Okay? And the people that you become once I've had 2 quarts of malt liquor are way better than you guys when you're sober. So it had an effect on me and an effect on you, and it made me comfortable and happy and confident and talkative. And I didn't realize, I don't think, till that first drunk, how locked up I was. You know, and I, you know, and again, some of this is in hindsight. I don't think I had these thoughts as a kid, but I was locked up inside. There was a barrier, a separation between me and you, and I just was so disconnected from people, and I thought a lot and said little, you know. And then when I started drinking, I thought little and said a lot. but anyway, I got drunk that first night. The consequences were immediate. First night, blackout, you know, crazy drunk, got sick. The last memory I had is of leaning back in my chair in this movie theater and urinating over the seat in front of me. Right? Everything after that is just gone, you know. But I thought it was funny, and my friends thought it was funny, but the rest of the people in the theater did not think it was funny, and we had to get up and go. There was a lot of get up and go because of something that I did during the next few years. That was a pattern that was going to happen. But anyway, but what happened though is, you know, we got back to my friend's house. I was spending the night out. I threw up all over his parents' living room, all over his parents' bathroom. And they all woke up and heard us and found out. So then he was in trouble. The other two kids involved parents got contacted, you know. And so anyway, everybody was in trouble. Everybody was in trouble because of me, because I'm the lightweight jerk off who can't hold his liquor. And so everyone was punished and whatever it was. I mean, 13 years old, my Atari got taken away, my allowance got taken away, whatever it might have been. And, but the next day, well, I woke up And my thought was not, I'm never doing that again, which I've heard a lot of young people get drunk like that the first time. You know, when you're a teenager, you know, you just do stupid stuff, and it's expected. And people say, God, I'm never doing that again. But I said, I can't wait to do that again. When are we doing that again? And we did it again the very next weekend. So that's how my drinking career took off. And we drank every weekend, and it was always stolen liquor. I lived in a nice, upper middle class suburban neighborhood. There were a lot of garages with a lot of refrigerators where a lot of people kept a lot of beer and wine and liquor. Sometimes there was 12 cases of beer stacked up in a garage, you know, and we'd liberate that beer, you know, for the greater good. So it was just like that, and that's how it went, and it was a weekend thing. And a lot of times we'd steal liquor. One of those deals where you get a big jar and you pour an inch of vodka and an inch of gin and an inch of vermouth and an inch of scotch and an inch of cream de menthe and just get this concoction of this foul, cloudy nastiness. And you're 14 years old and you're passing it around in the woods, you know, and saying things like, man, that's so good. That's so smooth, brother. You know, it's just going around. And the whole point was, and this is what it says in the big book, is I'm a person who drinks for the effect. The effect. And the effect on me was awesome. The effect on me was, I love this, and let's hit it harder, and let's do more, and let's start mixing in some other things. Because I started smoking weed and popping pills and doing all kinds of other things in there. But the other part about my relationship with alcohol is spiritual. The promises, you know, the ninth step promises, it talks about we will not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. When I'm drunk, I don't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. You know, some of the things that the promises that we get in here are the same promises that alcohol gave to me. It gave me this ability to kind of just tune into what I wanted to tune in and ignore everything I wanted to ignore and make me whole, you know. And that's exactly what the 12 steps do to me today. You know, they make me whole. You know, I actually am able to focus on that which I should focus on and ignore the silly, stupid, ego-driven stuff that I don't need to be focusing on in the first place. Whatever. I drank, I partied, I loved it all. I was always in trouble. I never got away with anything. Now, some people get away with stuff. My wife got away with a lot. She had this whole external persona of, like, success and, like, going to school and making grades, and I just didn't care about any of that. I'm the kind of alcoholic, as soon as I became an alcoholic, nothing else mattered. I played baseball. I loved baseball. I was good at baseball. I mean, the second that I started drinking, I was like, I'm done with baseball. I mean, I don't care how good the home run feels to hit. You know, I mean, it's a lot of practices and working out and showing up and schedules and routines to be able to occasionally hit a home run and have that really good feeling. And I mean, I got that really good feeling in 5 minutes, you know, and if it's, you know, however many hours of work it is to get that good feeling over here in 5 minutes over here, I'm going over here every single time. And so that's sort of, as it turns out, I'm very self-centered and I'm very lazy. And so alcohol works good for a guy like that. Anyhow, so I partied through, you know, junior high school, high school, ninth grade. I got kicked out of the ninth school. You know, my old man is a doctor. My old man is a really fascinating guy, and he's an ex-Marine, which kind of, I'll tell you that now, that figures into some stuff that happens down the road. But my old man's ex-Marine. Or as he would say, once you're a Marine, you're always a Marine. We probably got some jarheads in here. I got a whole bunch of jarheads in my family. Anyway, and veteran, and unfortunately he got me as a kid. And so by this time now, I'm in like ninth grade. I got long hair. I dress all in black. Okay? I like, you know, Slayer. You know, not what you see before you today. How about this jacket, by the way? Like, you know, Slayer, Metallica, Death Angel. I mean, black shirt, concert shirt, black jeans, black shoes, and, you know, long hair. And I'm just like a drunk stoner. And I had kicked out of the night school. You know, my old man had got me into the night school, like the college prep school, where all the kids who were going to be somebody were. And I wasn't going to be anybody. And I got kicked out of there after 5 months because a bunch of us went out and got drunk at lunch and popped a few pills and smoked a few things. And one kid, you know, some weak-ass loser, OD'd, and narked on everybody. And so we all got kicked out. And so I ended up where I wanted to be, which is, HB Plant High School, where all my degenerate friends went, you know. And so I ended up in the regular high school. And high school for me was like I knew a lot of kids who showed up. School was an opportunity for them. You know, school was not an opportunity for me. The good school was not an opportunity for me. The bad school was not an opportunity for me. School was a place for me to show up and hook up. And that was all that it was. And I did not care one bit about anything. I met my degenerate friends every morning about a half an hour before school. It was a golf course a little ways down, and there was some little wooded like area on the golf course. We met up in these woods, and we smoked dope, and we drank. And then we went off to school hammered. And then at lunchtime, we went back down to the woods, and we smoked dope, and we drank, and then we went back to school hammered. And that's just all it was, you know. I met my connections in high school. And so in my, let's see. Yeah, so I failed my junior year. My wife always laughs at this. I went to summer school every year of high school, okay. And then I lost so many, I missed so many credits or failed so many classes or whatever that I was not only going to summer school, but I was going to summer night school because there was no way to make up the credits in just summer school. You know, and where I was going to summer school, it's kind of a joke. It's like basically if you showed up, they just gave you a D and let you pass to the next grade, you know, which is about what my transcripts for high school for 3.5 years, which there's something coming there, you can tell, where it was exactly a 1.0. It was a 1.0 for 3.5 years of high school. But anyway, I failed my junior year. I couldn't make it up. I ended up repeating the junior year. And halfway through that year, I just quit. I just quit one day. And quitting high school, you know, I mean, it's a fairly big deal. It's a fairly big decision to make. And I made it one day in the hallway, like that, hammered. The dean was coming down the hall, and he had caught me like twice that morning just roaming the halls, you know, not in class. It's like, you know, Shires, get to class. Aren't you supposed to be in English? Going. And, you know, long hair, like 70s style, kind of out like this, you know. And anyway, he caught me the third time, and I was kind of standing in a corridor with some degenerate buddies of mine. And he said, "That's it, Shires, you're suspended," or whatever. And I thought it would be cool to tell him to tell him off. So I told him off, really in front of my friends, really because, and I want you to understand this about the guy standing in front of you. I am, as the big book says, I am an actor, okay? I am an actor. I am constantly putting on a show for you, okay? I have a stage character that I'm presenting to you. And not right now, tonight. I'm trying to be as genuine as I know how to be, which is probably at least 5% full of it, but, you know, as genuine as I know how to be. But I am a huge liar. It's not so much that I'm a liar, it's my whole life is a lie. And I'm presenting a stage character to you, and I'm putting on airs for you, and I'm trying to get your approval, I'm trying to get your love, I'm trying to get your admiration. And so that's what was going on that day. I was with my buddies, and I wanted to put on a show, and I was really hammered, and I don't make good decisions, even when I'm sober. So I just said, "Yeah, F you, man, I don't need your damn school, and you can stick it, you know." And so I went, and I dropped out. And I came home, and I was living with my dad now, and I told my dad, the Marine, the doctor, the self-made millionaire, okay? The guy who started his own business and grew it to 600 employees and came from nothing. I mean, my old man did. He literally came from nothing, went in the Marine Corps, fought in Korea, GI Bill, college, medical school, had 5 kids before he finished medical school, got out of medical school, started his own company, blah, 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 blah. Great success story. And, of course, he gets a bunch of kids like us, but particularly this one. But I came home, and my old man, he kicked me out. He's like, you know, "You're just a gold-bricking, hippy-dippy, loser alcoholic, and you're out, you know." And I didn't think I was a gold-dicking, hippy-dippy, loser alcoholic. I thought I was tough, and I thought I was strong, and I thought I was in touch with some very profound truths about society and the universe. And, you know, I mean, this is, it's funny, but I'm going to tell you, because I'm going to get sober here in a minute, and I'm going to tell you, I'm going to tell you some of my early thoughts in sobriety, and they're laughable too. But anyway, being a tough, strong, master of the universe type guy, I went back to live with my mother. And so I'm a high school dropout, full-blown alcoholic, partying all day, every day. My mother is dealing with her last ex-boyfriend who was an alcoholic. My mother is starting to go to Al-Anon, but she's not even remotely well yet. And so she's letting me and my brother, my other brother, who's a high school dropout, both live with her and not pay rent and gradually and slowly pawn everything of value in the house and steal money out of her wallet, you know. and just completely sponge, you know, just completely sponge off her. And she's getting sicker and sicker, and we're getting sicker and sicker. And finally, she kind of puts me out in the gentlest way. I mean, she put me out by, she helped me out. She helped me get into a car and get into an apartment and move to Gainesville, Florida to go to this junior college, helped me get enrolled there. So this is my big chance to prove to the world that I'm important, to prove, to, like Bill Wilson said, to prove to the world that I can succeed, that I'm not the screw-up that everybody says that I am. So I'm living in Gainesville, Florida. I got my own place. I'm going to college. I got a job. I'm doing all these things. And now there weren't really any handcuffs, there weren't any reins at this point, but whatever little bit of control that being living in my mother's house gave me was just gone. And I got to Gainesville, Florida, big college town, you know, it's this huge, great place for a potential alcoholic to grow up. And I just hit it harder and harder and harder and harder. And at the end of a year in Gainesville, Florida, I was living in a house with a degenerate, I mean, way more degenerate than any of the other degenerates. You know, the big book talks about near the end that we sought lower companionship, because it makes us feel better at ourselves. I'm a high school dropout, but this guy that I was living with, Steve, he dropped out in the sixth grade. And he was like a reform school kid all his life and been in and out of juvie all his life. And so I could always kind of point at Steve and say, if I ever get that bad, you know, I'll do something. But I'm living in this house. We're like 2-3 months behind on the rent. We're fixing to get evicted. Every utility's been turned off. You know, it's like February, March of 1989. It's wintertime. It's cold. Even in, you know, Florida, it gets cold in February. And we got no gas, no electric, no nothing. They finally turned the water off. The water was the last thing to go. And I remember the end came when, not showering. Okay, I can live with that. You know, I mean, people didn't shower for hundreds and hundreds of years before plumbing was invented. You know, so I can get in touch spiritually, like I'm just living the earthy way, you know, and I can stink and blah, blah, blah. And toothbrushes are modern, you know, contrivances of the man. And but when you can't flush the toilet, that's when it starts to become real for me. But the solution was we would steal the hose from the next door neighbor in the middle of the night and run it into the bathroom and flush the toilet, you know. Brush your teeth, get a little glass of water. And as sick, as disgusting as all that is, my take on it at the time, now remember, in the doctor's opinion, it says, I am unable to differentiate the true from the false, and my alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Well, stealing water to flush my toilet seemed like the most creative solution to a difficult problem. Like, I literally pat myself on the back about that. Like, John, a lot of guys couldn't even handle this. You know, like, you are like the alcoholic MacGyver who's getting in there and figuring it out, you know. And anyway, about this time, my Al-Anon mother kind of talked me into going to rehab, you know. And I did not believe at this point, I want you to understand this clearly, I did not believe I was an alcoholic or a drug addict, okay. Even though I'm drinking basically morning till night, I'm doing every drug that I can get my hands on morning till night. And I'm just completely out of control. But the rehab that she wanted me to go to, a family member had gone to this rehab before, so we kind of had a connection to it, it was in Atlanta. And I went to this rehab because they had running water and electricity and hot chocolate and tennis courts. And so it was just a way better deal. And it was a total scam. My plan at this time was to go to rehab, to get my mom off my back, to get back in her good graces, to basically set myself up to be able to manipulate her a little more down the road. And I didn't think of it in exactly those kind of calculating terms, but that's 100% what it was. Like, I wasn't like, manipulate the mother. You know, I wasn't like, it wasn't that deliberate, right? But that's exactly what it was. And so I went to rehab with those, you know, motivations, those goals. And what happened was, it's exactly what's happening here tonight. You know, at the very beginning of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the very first, the title page, it says, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. It's a story, right? And this is the most powerful thing we've got. Whether it's this conference like we're at tonight, whether it's your speaker meeting in your local group, whether it's somebody sharing a little bit of their story in an open discussion meeting, the story is what carries the message. right? I mean, I can read the big book on my own till I'm blue in the face, and I did, by the way, in early recovery. I read the hell out of the big book and missed all the important bits. Just zoom, 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 right over the head, you know? But when an alcoholic who is armed with the facts about himself, meaning he has worked the 12 steps and can talk about it, put some skin and bones to it, some flesh and blood to it, tells his story, man, I just connect, you know? And so these men and women would come into this rehab and do this, exactly what I'm doing tonight, tell their stories, and I would just sit there and nod, you know, and be like, oh my God, I really connect with this girl, you know, who's like 50 years old, which is how old I am, by the way, this old lady, you know? I'm 52. I was the young guy when I got sober. Now I'm 52. Anyway, and I would connect with it. And then the next week, it would be like a black man, and I would connect with him. The next week, it would be like a white young guy, and I would connect with him. And the next week, it would be like some gay, flaming homosexual guy, and I would totally connect with him. And after like about a month of this, every single speaker coming in, I'm connecting to, every single one, and I'm sitting in the meetings, and I'm listening to what people are saying. My first surrender happened, and I want to emphasize my first surrender happened, because I have come to believe there is a series of surrenders that has to happen for me to get sober. Okay, but the first one happened, which was, I am like these people. Okay, and really, which is kind of profound for someone who is a loner and an isolator. I mean, I ran with people, but I was never with, you know, people. I drank with people and I partied with people, but I was never connected with people, and definitely not when I was sober. So I am sober, I am connecting to people really for the first time in my life. And so I'm like, I love these people. These are my tribe, these are my family. I'm running with these guys. Whatever they're doing, I'm doing. I'm an alcoholic, I'm in AA, here we go. And that took place in about 30 days in rehab. I got out of rehab and I did the whole, halfway house, outpatient treatment, you know, continuing care, three-quarter house, 13/16 house, you know, blah, 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 blah. I spent my entire first year of sobriety in, you know, some form of like a therapeutic community. But I was going to AA, and I was every single day, 7 days a week, sometimes two meetings a day, sometimes three meetings a day, especially on the weekends, you know. And then there was, you know, the equivalent of sinless sober mania. And then there was the Young People's Convention. And then there was the state convention. And then there was Atlanta Roundup. And there was just bing, 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 all these events and then workshops and all this kind of stuff. And I was just running with a crazy, crazy crowd of people my age, you know, 20, 21 years old. Some of them too young, you know, some 13 and 14-year-olds, you know. And there's 25-year-olds sleeping with 15-year-olds. And it's just a total chaotic mess of insanity. And God knows, people probably went to jail. But that's what it looked like. It was just a bunch of crazy young people who don't really understand Alcoholics Anonymous, but love it. And that's exactly where I was. I did not understand Alcoholics Anonymous, but I loved it. So we ran around and did all this stuff. And that first year was probably the best year of my life. And so looking back now, I can say, look, I had no program that first year. I had no sponsor, okay? By the way, if you have no sponsor, it means you're being sponsored by an idiot yourself. Okay, so I was being sponsored by an idiot. I had no sponsor. I was not working any of the 12 steps. I was talking about them in discussion meetings sometimes, you know. We'd have a discussion meeting, and the topic would be step 7. Okay, we're going to talk about step 7 today. And I'd be 4 months sober, and I'd raise my hand. I got no sponsor. I got no home group. I've never worked the steps, but I'm going to share about step 7. Okay, and I'm going to say something like, you know, when I think of step 7, I think of this, you know. And then everybody else in the meeting was doing the same thing. You know, it was the blind leading the blind, and we're all delusional, you know, and we're all running around crazy, and, you know, half of us are pregnant, and half of us have sexually transmitted diseases. I'm not recommending this. I'm just sharing my crazy experience. So that kind of rolls along like that. I decided, though, I got a job. I started making money. It's amazing, actually. Physical sobriety and a little tiny bit of willingness can get you pretty far to begin with, right? And if you're not spending every dollar that you're earning on alcohol and drugs, that gets you pretty far. You know, so I started having these experiences. I got an apartment. I got a car. I had a job. My family, my parents particularly, are now overjoyed that I'm sober because they were just watching me go down the tubes. So my relationships with my parents are getting better, okay? I decided I'm going to go back to school. Oh, this is the delusional thing I wanted to tell you. So, let me just say something about delusion, because it's one of my favorite topics to talk about. Delusion is, we talk a lot, and it's really come out of the treatment and the recovery kind of superstructure, you know, the idea of denial, okay? Denial. We all hear about that, you know, and they used to say it all the time, denial's not a river in Egypt, you know, and blah, blah, blah. But what I suffer from is delusion, okay? And it's worse. It's worse than denial. That's the point I want to make. Okay, if you're in denial about something, okay, you know, you stole somebody's wallet, and then you lied about it. You know you stole it, right? But delusional is, I stole your wallet. I don't even know that I stole it. I help you look for it. You know? Right? It's like worse, right? It's like once an alcoholic gets to denial, he has improved. Okay? So, I am delusional and I do not see the truth about my life. My perceptions about my life are not to be trusted. Okay? Especially early in recovery, but actually with a lot of time sometimes. I can have a lot of time away from a drink and still be completely wrong about my take on my life, my take on your life, and I'm making my judgments based on what I think you're thinking, which is like three steps away from reality right there, you know, and then I'm taking action based on these kind of things, right? So anyway, so I'm totally delusional. I decided I'm going to go back to school, okay? And when I was in rehab, right, they had this SAT class. See, let me just say this. I'm an intelligent human being. I got high intelligence, okay? I was tested young. I was, like, getting gifted programs when I was young and all this kind of stuff. So I get sober. I take the SAT. I do really well on it. I'm a high school dropout, scumbag, alcoholic junkie with a good SAT score who's a high school dropout, okay? So I'm like, I'm going to apply to college. So where should I apply? The best college in the city, which is Emory University, okay? So I apply to Emory University. I write this, you know, when part of the application process to like a college is the personal statement, okay? And it's like, tell us about yourself. Give us a personal statement. Tell us something meaningful about your life, something that's important to you. So I write, I am John and I am an alcoholic. First sentence, right? And then I pour out this like therapeutic, like destructive family sickness background and long history of abuse and psychotic relationships and blah, 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 blah. And I write this thing out and I rewrite it and I rewrite it and I rewrite it and I make it perfect. I mean, it was, and I send it off. And they wrote me this really nice letter back saying, Mr. Shires, we're so glad you're finding some help. We think you want to try a junior college and get some track record and blah, blah, blah. I don't know who took the time to actually answer that letter, but somebody did. But my reaction was, I was crushed because I was 100% expecting them to read that personal statement and be like, this guy is awesome. Look at the honesty. Look at the commitment to self-improvement. You know, like this is Emory material, you know. Anyway, I was really crushed. But then someone, you know, one of my AA buddies was like, why don't you do what they said and just apply to junior college? So I did. I started my, you know, applied to junior college. But that's just how delusional I am. You know, I didn't run that idea by a sponsor because I didn't have a sponsor. I ran that idea by me, saw that it was sound, and went with it. Anyway, but I started, you know, a lot of things did start to get better in my life. You know, I'm making money. I'm sober. I have a circle of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my first couple of two and a half years went like that. Remember earlier I was talking about surrender? And so that first surrender is I come in here, even if I don't say it out loud, I come in here and I'm looking for some kind of help. And I don't necessarily, I have a hard time asking for help, okay? Maybe the hardest single thing that I've ever had to do is say to another man, I'm dying of alcoholism, I need your help, will you sponsor me? Okay? And if anybody in this room is having a hard time with that, I get you and I understand that 100%. But do it anyway and just see what happens. But I wasn't able to do that yet. So the first 2.5 years in AA, I think a lot of us do this. All right, I had made one surrender. I had surrendered to alcohol. I have a problem with alcohol. I am going to AA meetings and I'm treating my problem with alcohol. Okay, you got these steps and these traditions and these concepts and these books and, you know, that's for the people who have a really bad case of alcoholism. But, you know, mine's enough to just go to meetings and hang out with sober people and smoke a lot of cigarettes and, you know, chase a lot of girls. And so that was my program of action, as I said. So 2.5 years sober, this is what my life looks like. I am making more money I'm waiting tables now at a halfway decent restaurant, Chili's, and making decent money waiting tables. I'm in school. I have actually made it to Emory University. I don't think I deliberately set out to do this, but I did follow their directions. I went to the junior college for 5 quarters, and I made straight A's. It's amazing what you can do when you're sober. Just being sober does do some things for me. You know, I can make good grades. I can actually bring books home from class. And I can actually do assignments. And I can actually remember to bring them with me back to the school the next day. And stuff like that. So I did all this stuff. I'm rocking and rolling along. I made straight A's. I transferred over to Emory University. Now I'm insufferable. Okay? Now I have made it to the big university. Right? I'm a high school dropout scumbag, and now I'm going to university. Oh, I had cut my hair by this time. I could look more or less like I do today, although younger and thinner and better looking. But I'm going to university. I'm working. I'm making money. I've got a 1991 model car in 1991. Okay? I mean, that was the first time in my life I'd ever had the same model year car as the year I was living in, which is, you know, isn't that a symbol of success? You know? What year is that? That's a 91. Yeah. Tahitian green. Yeah, that's right. So I'm going to Emory. I've got the car. I'm living in the cool part of town, the little artsy cool part of town where all the clubs and bars are. You know, I'm living in the cool part of town. And I'm going to the good university. And everybody knows me in AA. I go to 7 AA meetings a week. And there's 10,000 people in AA that know me by first name. You know, John's here. Ah! And I'm like, ah, I'm here. Ah! You know. And but the outsides look great. Outsides look great. Better than they had ever been. In fact, they were great. They were better than they had ever been. You know, I got the car. I'm a guitar player. I got the guitar. I got the real nice amplifier. I got the effects rack. You know, I got the girl. I got the apartment. You know, I got the university. I got my parents are proud of me. Everyone's happy. You know, I got no legal problems. I got no tax problems. I got none of the big problems that you have when you first come into AA. And I'm dying inside. And I'm thinking about killing myself or drinking almost every day. And I'm not telling anybody about that. Because when I'm sharing in AA, my wife and I have this, we are both so full of it. And we both have had the same experience of coming into AA and zipping myself up in an AA recovery suit and going to the meetings and putting on this persona and being the actor, and I'm dying inside. And people, and I would share in the meetings. And I felt, and this is how delusional I am, I felt like it was my responsibility to share some kind of positive, you know, gung-ho solution in the meeting. So I would share my BS about step 7, which I had never worked, you know, and I would share it pretty good. And then somebody would come up to me after the meeting and go, God, John, whenever you share, man, God, I just love you. And I would say something like, keep coming, man. It'll work for you too. You know, like, and I don't even see when I'm doing this just how much of a fraud I am, how much of a phony I am. Some poor schlep asked me to sponsor him then. Oh. And he asked me one day, I've been sponsoring him a few months, and for me at that time, sponsoring, I just took him to all the meetings I went to and drank coffee with him and loaned him cigarettes. Like it says in the big book. And this guy says to me, hey man, when are we going to do my fourth and fifth step? Oof. And here's how sick I am. What I said to him is, hey, who's sponsoring who here? So I basically, because I hadn't done it, and he embarrassed me, I kind of basically suppressed his desire to do it. That's sick. That's some sick stuff. So anyhow, about this time, I just hit bottom. I almost get drunk at this party that I had no business being at, a big fraternity thing. I'm as far as you could get from a fraternity guy, if you can't already tell. You know, I'm like a goofy, artsy, weird, kind of eccentric dude. And anyway, I almost get drunk, and I go back to my home group to ask this guy to sponsor me. This guy that I hated. Okay, I asked the guy that I hated to sponsor me. And you know why I hated him? Because he carried that big book. You know how you do. Everywhere he went. Under his arm. And it was dog-eared and marked up and had prayers on pamphlets hanging out of it, and he shared about the book, and he shared about his amends. He'd actually done amends, you know, and he would share about, particularly he would share about the amends that he did with his father, because I hated my father. I hated his guts. And he would share about that stuff and talk about the healing that had taken place and how He had almost killed his father in a physical fist fight one time that they'd gotten into. And later on, when his father was dying of cancer, he was lying in bed with him, holding him, telling him he loved him. You know, and make everybody in the room cry. You know, I was like, you know, you know. But some part of me recognized the truth about what he was. He was having a different experience here than I was having. Okay? And some of part of it was genuine. I need to hold on my phone to make sure about the time limit. So, anyway, asked him to sponsor me. Long story short. And he said, I will. And we started going through the big book. Started page one. Page zero. Page nothing. Right? the whole experience. Turn to the first page of the book, and I turn to Bill's story, right? Page one, Bill's story. He's like, no, turn to the first page of the book. So I turn back to the Roman numerals? Jeez, who reads the freaking Roman numerals pages? You know, doctor's opinion? No, go all the way to the beginning. The title page? No, all the way to the beginning. You know, finally I get to the blank page, right? And I said, this here, the blank page? He says, yeah, what does it say? He says, nothing. He goes, that is what you know about staying sober. Now shut up and read and listen. And you know, he was pretty hardcore about it. And I was like, oh, God, what have I gotten myself into? But I was beaten. And this is where the second surrender takes place, is I had done 1,000 AA meetings in 2.5 years, and I was ready to kill myself or drink or both. And so I really had little fight left in me, and I believed this guy had something that I didn't. So I said, okay. And we went through the big book, and we joined his sponsor and a group of guys in his sponsor's basement. There's like 40 guys in a basement, like twice a week, with one of those gigantic, like 200 cup coffee urns. And like everybody in the basement smoked like 2 packs of cigarettes in 2 hours. And we would listen to Joe and Charlie tapes, and then we would read up to wherever they'd gotten to, and we would talk about it. And then when it said pray, we would get on our third step prayer, we'd get on our knees, we all say a third step prayer. You know, and we would just go through it. So like in 6 months, I went through the 12 steps in this fashion. I really was maybe slightly longer than that, but it really was not a very long period of time. And it was my first pass through the steps. And it wasn't like exhaustive, and it wasn't perfect. My first inventory, I look at it now. So what it says, right, is we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. I don't know how fearless and thorough it was looking back now. It wasn't very thorough for sure. Fearless, maybe, it was probably more fearless than it was thorough. Okay, but I look back now and I laugh at it. It was like 12 legal pages, like yellow legal pad pages of stuff. You know, I mean, it was like by the book. I mean, it was resentment, it was fear, it was sex conduct. And here's what happened. At the end of that fifth step with my sponsor, I was 100% clear that I was self-centered. I don't think I took much more than that away. But I really did not believe that line in our big book where it says selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of the problem. See, I have delusions and lies that mean that that's not true. I one time gave my shirt to a homeless man. What, right? What a great guy I am. And that's a true story. I really gave my shirt to a homeless man. And whenever anything would come up that might point to the fact that I'm selfish and self-centered, I gave my shirt to a homeless man. But that's how my alcoholic mind works. Right, I have little instances of one thing that mean that this whole other thing can't be true. But by the time I got done with that fifth step, it was clear that I was selfish and self-centered. So a couple of other things were clear, but that's the one big thing that became clear. But it opened up a new chapter in my AA life. And so I started running with these guys. I started really participating in a home group. I started sponsoring guys and sitting down with them and reading the big book with them and trying to help them to have a new experience. I started doing service work. I got involved in the Young People's Convention. I was on the bid committee and then the host committee for the International Conference of Young People in 1994 when it was in Atlanta, which makes me very old, and I don't like talking about it. Anyway, my life started to take off. I'm going to have to fast forward because it's funny how time flies, you know, when you're doing this. But my life started to take off. And I finished college. I met this girl right here at a young people's dance in Columbus, Georgia in 1993. And I was there doing outreach for the young people's dance, and she was there because she liked to dance. And she came all the way from Statesboro, Georgia, which was a couple hours away. So anyway, this is how God works. She was 4 years sober, and I was 4 years sober. And a year later, she was newly sober, you know, and I was 5 years sober, but with a program of action. And we met in my home group in Atlanta when she moved there. And over the next year, we got together, fell in love, moved in together, and had my sponsor and his wife, he was 25 years sober, she was 25 years in Al-Anon, had them blessing us. Like, you can move in together, and we're going to do the 12 traditions, and I'm going to show you how to live sober and be a sober man and a sober woman and a sober husband and a sober wife. You know, and we got all this help about how to apply the 12 traditions to the family. And like I said, we just celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary. We've been together 28 years. Now, prior to working the 12 steps, I had 28 relationships. And they were all exactly the same. They were all 2 to 6 weeks. They were all, I fell in love with her on the way to the coffee pot. Okay? Had sex that night. She was the one. God sent her to me. I met her in a meeting, you know. And then 2 weeks later, and we hate each other. Move on to the next one. Wash, rinse, repeat. So these kinds of miracles began to happen in my life. And this is all a byproduct of the steps and the traditions and sponsorship. I just want to be 100%. This is nothing that anything that I figured out. These are the gifts that have been given to me. So my then fiance and I moved to Connecticut. I got accepted to graduate school. So I got a degree in biology, which is essentially useless unless you're going to be a physician or a scientist. And I was going to be a physician, follow my old man's footsteps. But then I realized that I was just following his footsteps, and I didn't really want to be a physician. So I guess I'm going to have to be a scientist. So I applied to all these graduate programs, got accepted at Yale University, moved up to Connecticut. Alcoholic scumbag junkie going to Yale University. Okay? My wife and I move up there. I almost got kicked out of Yale University, by the way. 8 years sober. I opened my mouth to tell a joke that had no business being told in the office, and I very nearly got me kicked out. So I just want to say, I told you at the beginning, I like talking about my mistakes, you know? And this is what I keep learning over and over and over again. There is no amount of clean time, there is no amount of sobriety that means I will not be an alcoholic. And the real deal with being an alcoholic means alcohol is not my problem, okay? And that might sound weird if you're new. Hell, it might sound weird if you've been here for a little while, because it did to me. But alcohol is not my problem. An alcoholic is not someone who has an alcohol problem. An alcoholic is someone who has an alcohol answer to a spiritual problem. Okay? I am spiritually flawed. I have character defects that are hardwired into me. And the only way that I'm like happy and joyous and free, whether it's today or tomorrow or yesterday or any day that happy event comes to pass in my life, is because I have a program of action that keeps me plugged into God. Okay? And I don't even understand God, you know? And for someone who's a scientist and an intellectual and like an overthinker, that's an amazing thing to say. I don't understand God, and I don't need to understand God. If I could understand God, I sure as hell wouldn't need him, you know? So it's really good to not, if there's things you don't understand, good. If I can take action without understanding, that means I'm listening to somebody besides myself. That means I'm sponsorable, and I need to cultivate this quality of being sponsorable, right? Of being willing to take suggestions that don't come from me and my diseased brain. But anyway, we lived in Connecticut, and this will surprise them. Anyone in here ever moved in sobriety? Just by show of hands, anybody ever moved yet in sobriety? Okay, quite a few people. Didn't the AA suck where you moved to? Right? So we moved to Connecticut. AA sucks here. We're going to have to start a home group. You know? So we did. Started a home group. Fell in with some other people there who felt kind of the same way. They wanted to start a home group. So we started a home group. So the whole time that I'm in graduate school and I'm busting my butt and I'm studying and I'm working on all that, I'm sponsoring dozens of guys. I'm in a home group. I've got a service commitment. I'm going to the district meetings. I'm involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the first priority of my life. I mean, today, right now, I sponsor 15, 20 guys. I mean, I say 15, 20, only half of them are sponsorable at any given moment, right? I mean, the other half are working on a relapse or coming back from a relapse or trying to surrender the second or third or fourth time. But I sponsor a ton of guys, okay? Currently, I don't have an annual position in my home group. I was the website chair last year, you know, but currently I am like a cleanup person in my home group. You know, I am a greeter at my home group. You know, I have a job every month at my home group. My home group does commitments at halfway houses and treatment centers and jails. You know, and I'm the jail guy on Tuesday night. You know, I go to the prison. It's not jail. It's actually prison. I go to the prison on Tuesday night and do the AA meeting with a couple of other home group members. You know, we do this prison meeting on Tuesday nights. And I love the prison. And I never went to prison. I didn't even came close to prison. I went to jail for exactly 18 hours with 2 years of sobriety. That's my whole jail experience. You know, some more of that unmanageability for you. But anyway, we moved to Connecticut, hated the AA, started a group there. By the time that group got off and running, we got called away again, and we moved to London, England for 4 years. You can imagine, you know, so the AA in London sucked, and they didn't have coffee, because all they drink is tea over there. So we started a group there, stayed there for 4 years, moved back to Atlanta, where we had always wanted to get back to, where AA was awesome. AA sucked when we got back to Atlanta. So we started a home group. The point of all this is, I don't know what's good for me. I don't know what's bad for me. I am filled with judgment and ego. I have character defects that I haven't even uncovered yet. Okay? And that's fine. You can be happily sober and very flawed, right? If I'm just willing to do what's put in front of me to do. And there's always service work to be done. There's always another thing that needs to happen. So, I neglected to mention, we had our first child. We'd been married like a year. Less than a year, I think, got pregnant, had our first child in year two. Little boy, awesome. He's 23 today. He sells weed. Isn't that cute? He works at a dispensary. He makes $50,000 a year in Colorado selling weed legally, and he gets 40% off on his weed. Clearly born in the wrong era, right? Anyway, a cute little baby comes into our life, and he was, you know, a joy and a huge burden. And we love him dearly, if you're ever listening to this, son. And then we moved to London. We had our second child in London. He's 21 years old today. He is an actor. He is actually able to make most of his living from acting. He also works in the restaurant industry, which most actors do. If there's any actors present, you know what I'm talking about. And he's awesome. He also smokes weed like it's going to be made illegal tomorrow. You know, both my kids are... They're wild and crazy kids, like their mother and I. We are wild and crazy kids and wild and crazy adults, wild and crazy AA members. And that's just the way it is. God was in our household. AA was in our household. And my kids know where to go if they ever get into trouble. You know, my wife asked one of our kids one time, what do you think we do at those meetings? Oh, you go there to learn how to be better parents. Which is not too far from the truth, actually. So anyway, and then we... So we're rocking and rolling. So we got these two kids. They're like 6 and 4, and we get pregnant for a third time. And we've been hoping for a little girl, right? You know, we got the two boys. My wife is in a house full of boys. She wants a daughter, you know, so we got our wish. We got pregnant again. It's a girl, hooray, right? So we're rocking and rolling along, and we get to 9 months. And at the particular clinic that we go to, for the prenatal stuff and all that, they want to do a scan on you at 9 months, and they're going to induce you. If you're not going to deliver the damn baby by 9 months, they're going to induce you to deliver the baby. So we go in for that scan, and we get this terrible news. You know, the doctor says, look, every scan up to now has been normal, but there's something abnormal about your daughter's brain, and we are sending you to the hospital right now to do an emergency C-section, and we have the neonatal intensive care brain specialist surgeons on call, and they're going to be there, so go, 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 go. And it was like a punch in the stomach. You know, and this is something that happens, right? Because we get sober and because we surrender and because we do God's will to the best of our ability, doesn't mean that we're immune from life, right? Life is going to happen. People are going to die. People are going to get sick. Life's going to punch you in the gut sometimes. So we got a gut punch on this particular day. And we go to the hospital and we made it, you know, so this was 2004, right? So we made a couple of phone calls, got a couple of voicemails. It's the middle of the day. You know, oh, my God, we're going to the hospital. Something's wrong with the baby, you know. And got to the hospital, got in there, you know, surgery. They took our daughter out. She looked totally fine, by the way. They pulled her out, and she was like, looked totally normal. But they rushed her off to the ICU hospital across the street. My wife's now recovering from surgery, and everyone in AA just showed up like you wouldn't believe. The phone calls just started coming in. I got two little boys at home. I got a wife recovering in one hospital, an infant daughter who's going to need brain surgery in the ICU children's hospital across the street, and these two little kids at home and work and everything. I'm running around like crazy, and people showed up. with no request from us at all, other than this is what's going on. People showed up and they mowed our lawn and they cleaned our house and they did our laundry. The Al-Anons showed up with casseroles like you wouldn't believe, right? Matter of fact, 3 years after all this went down, I finally threw out the last of the frozen Al-Anon casseroles. Didn't even know they were in our extra fridge, like down in the basement, extra freezer. My daughter, my daughter is fine today. She's 17 years old. She is a special needs child. She had brain surgery. She has brain damage from the stroke that she had in the womb, which was just one of those unexplainable things that life throws at you sometimes. But she's absolutely the joy of our life. And my wife and I, Joe, we were joking today with Wendy. You know, so I have two boys who are complete. Well, I don't want to say they're normal. I have two boys that are relatively normal who have just been a challenge from day one because they're super bright, they're super precocious, and they're borderline alcoholics. And I've got this special needs child who's the most loving, easy child. So we always joke that our special needs kid's the best one we got. So again, one more time, I don't know what's good for me. I don't know what's right and wrong in my life. I have an illness of perception, you know, and so I've just learned to roll with that. But I want to tell you the follow-up story on some of this is it was this guy in our big book study at this time. So that guy whose house we met in and did the Joe and Charlie big book studies is still sober, still alive this time. And he's doing a big book study at his house. And there's this cat in our big book study. He's just one of these. I mean, every one of you knows this guy, right? Man, I'm not going in for this God shit, man. You know, just like just angry and it just full of old ideas and judgment and kind of stuck, just so spiritually stuck, you know, and he hated the way that the word God was capitalized in the big book, right? It says God, it says the great capital, reality capital, you know. And his name was M, lowercase, because he didn't believe in capitalization, which is a pretty weird stance to take. He was a 6'6", like, ex-beatnik guy. He was just this hyper-intelligent, like, stuck spiritual guy. Anyway, so my daughter's about 6 months old. She's out of danger. We're you know, our life is settling back down into normal. You know, she's had her surgeries and she's recovering. She's doing good. And so he's working on our deck. He's a carpenter. So he's come to help out, do some work on our deck. And he says, hey, man, I just want to tell you something, man. I got something to tell you, man. You know, because that's just how he talks. And I said, okay, Em, what is it, man? Okay, lowercase, you know. And he says, hey, it's because of your little girl that I believe in God. And I had, with all the drama going on in my life, I'd kind of stopped paying too much attention to Em's life and didn't really realize he had 6 months sober for the first time. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing. Why do you say that? What's going on? What's the deal? He goes, when she was born, it was that day. He goes, I was talking to Dennis. Dennis was his sponsor and my former grand sponsor. And he said, you're going to shut up and follow directions or you're going to get another sponsor. And the first direction is I want you to go home tonight and get on your knees and pray for God to help you, pray for somebody besides your self-centered, disgusting, alcoholic, junkie self. Because that's the way Dennis was. Dennis was no bones. He was just like, do it or get another sponsor. I don't care which, you know. And so he said, this is what he said. He said to his sponsor at that moment, he said, there's not one person on this planet worthy of my prayers. Isn't that great? It's so alcoholic, right? The whole world sucks. Right? And everybody in it in particular, you know. And he said, well, do it or find another sponsor. And he goes, and later that day, I heard about your daughter being born, having the surgery in the brain. And he goes, you know what? He said, the thought that came to me was, there's somebody, this little baby girl in the hospital who can't yet have done anything wrong. She just got born. And she kind of got a raw deal. And there's somebody that's worthy of a prayer. He said, so I started praying for Kinsey. I started praying for Kinsey that night. And I've been praying for her every day since then. And that has opened the door to me to have a slightly different understanding of God. And now I'm good. I'm good with that. And I'm doing my deal. And it just blew my mind. You know, now I want to say this because this is the kind of misunderstanding I might have taken from that story when I was new. I don't believe that God messed my little girl's brain up to help M. Okay? But I believe in God's hands, even the worst experiences can be converted to usefulness for others. You know? And if I am showing up in AA like I'm charged to do in the big book, and trying to be helpful to others, then others will be helped. And by doing that, I end up being helped. This is the goofy part, AA. You know, I just want to feel good. That's all I care about, right? I am self-centered. I want to feel good. And what our sponsors say, go help that newcomer. You know, go carry that meeting to that detox. Go get on Sinless Sober Mania. Even if you hate everybody else on the committee, show up and make the freaking coffee, right? This is the kind of stuff we get. I know there's people in this room who've called their sponsor saying, this bitch on the committee, I hate her. This John ass on the committee, I hate him. You know? Because I've been on those committees. And those are the conversations I had too. Anyway, to carry that story just a little further, a couple years later, and I'm going to shut up after this, but a couple years later, I'm talking to my sponsor, just like the weekly check-in. You know, my sponsor lives out of state at this time. He lives in Manhattan, Kansas, and I'm living in Atlanta, Georgia. Talk to him every week. And I say, so, well, you know, Jared, tell me about you. How are you doing? And he says, John, I'm doing great. He goes, you know, I got a clean bill of health from my doctor the other day. You know, that I'm one more year and I will be deemed completely cancer free. I said, what? So this is like, I think I want to say my daughter's like 2 or 3 years sober at this moment. Yeah. What?
2 or 3 years old.
I mean, two. I'm sorry. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. The brain thing was a byproduct of her drinking in the womb. She's 2 or 3 years old this time. And I say to my sponsor, so what are you talking about? He said, oh, well, you know, I had the liver cancer and all those surgeries and everything. I said, Ben, this is news to me. I mean, I know we live in different states, but you never told me about this. Haven't I told you? Well, yeah, man, you know, 3 years ago I got diagnosed with liver cancer, and the doctor said I was going to die, but then my kids refused it. They took me down to MD Anderson, and they got this done and that done. They took my liver out, and they gave me this experimental drug, and it looks like they pretty much cured my liver cancer, and, you know, I'm going to be okay. So I started doing the math in my head, and I called my sponsor because my daughter was in the hospital, my wife was in the hospital, and I was losing my mind, and he never mentioned the fact that he just got diagnosed with liver cancer. You know? He took every call, and you can imagine that was a lot of calls. Took every phone call and never mentioned that he's facing a death sentence from liver cancer. He goes through chemo and radiation and surgery and never mentions it to me as I'm calling him to tell him what's going on with my daughter. And I said to him, Jerry, how come he never told me? He goes, you might have stopped calling me. Isn't that a pretty profound example of sponsorship? And I mean, I'm, whatever, 15, 20 years sober at this point. And he's still more spiritual than me. Because I don't think I'd have done that. I'd have been like, dude, I got cancer, go drink. You know? I mean, probably not, right? But what an example. What an example of this amazing program. And I keep seeing this stuff. The more times I surrender, the more times I go back to the steps, the more times I go back to this amazing process that basically just clears all of the wreckage, my internal wreckage, out of the way so I can connect to the Spirit, right? The more gifts that come. There's a line in our big book. It says, when we looked back, we saw that the things that came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned, right? But the first part of that sentence says, when we look back, we see that. You don't see that up front. I don't get to see the gifts and the miracles on the front end. I'm required to take action without seeing that. That's what's called faith. Right? So my prayer for y'all is that you guys can find the courage and the faith to take those actions. Do all 12 steps. If you've done them before and you're miserable again and you haven't done them for a while, do them again. Hell, see what happens. And keep showing up at these kind of events. Keep showing up at your home group. Keep sponsoring guys and gals and carrying the message to places where people need to hear it. Because there's a lot of people that all of us in this room would be dead if one crackpot alcoholic had not gone to ridiculous lengths to seek out another crackpot alcoholic, right? That's the God's honest truth, man. If one thing had gone differently in Bill Wilson's week that week when he finally went to find Dr. Bob, we wouldn't be here, you know? And that's still true. That's still true today. So thanks for letting me share. I love all y'all.